comes from 1 Samuel chapters 18 and 19, certain selections out of those chapters to give us the sense of the flow of them. 1 Samuel chapter 18, beginning to read from at verse 6. The war season is over. The Israelites are coming home after the Goliath has been slain and others. This is what happens. As they were coming home, when David returned from slaying the Philistine, the women came out from of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul with timbrels, with songs of joy, and with instruments of music. And the women sang to one another as they made merry, "Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very angry, and this saying displeased him. He said, "They have ascribed to David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed thousands. And what more can he have but the kingdom?" And Saul eyed David from that day on. And on the morrow, an evil spirit from God rushed upon Saul, and he raved within his house while David was playing the lyre, as he did day by day. Saul had his spear in his hand, and Saul cast the spear, for he thought, "I will pin David to the wall." But David evaded him twice. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David, but had departed from Saul. So Saul removed him from his presence and made him a commander of 1,000, and he went out and came in before the people. And David had success in all his undertakings, for the Lord was with him. And when Saul saw that he had great success, he stood in awe of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David, for he went out and came in before them. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my elder daughter, Merib. I will give her to you for a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles." For Saul thought, "Let not my hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him." And David said to Saul, "Who am I and who are my kinsfolk, my father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But at the time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, she was given to Adriel, the Meholathite, for a wife. Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. Saul thought, "Let me give her to him, that she may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." Therefore Saul said to David a second time, "You shall now be my son-in-law." And Saul commanded his servants, "Speak to David in private, and say to him, 'Behold, the king has delight in you, and all his servants love you. Now then become the king's son-in-law.'" And Saul's servants spoke those words in the ears of David, and David said, "Does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, seeing that I'm a poor man and of no repute?" And the servants of Saul told him, "Thus and so did David speak." Then Saul said, "Thus shall you say to David, 'The king desires no marriage present except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies.'" Now Saul thought to make David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when his servants told David these words, it pleased David to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David arose and went along with his men and killed 200 of the Philistines, and David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave his daughter, Michal, for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal loved him, Saul was still more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually. Then the princes of the Philistines came out to battle, and as often as they came out, David had more success than all the servants of Saul, and so his name was highly esteemed. Now in chapter 19, Saul comes out of the closet and shows that he wants to wipe out David. And Jonathan, Saul's son, intervenes, tries to reconcile them, which seems successful. And again, Saul tries to nail David to the wall while he's playing for him. And after that, David knows that he must escape, picking up the narrative at chapter 19, verse 11. That night, Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him, that he might kill him in the morning. But Michal, David's wife, told him, "If you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed." So Michal let David down through the window, and he fled away and escaped. Michal took an image and laid it on the bed and put a pillow of goat's hair at its head and covered it with the clothes. And when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, "He's sick." Then Saul sent the messengers to see David, saying, "Bring him up to me in the bed that I may kill him." And when the messengers came in, behold, the image was in the bed, with a pillow of goat's hair at its head. Saul said to Michal, "Why have you deceived me thus, and let my enemy go so that he has escaped?" And Michal answered Saul, "He said to me, 'Let me go. Why should I kill you?'" Now David fled and escaped and came to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he and Samuel went and dwelt in Nioth. And it was told Saul, behold, David is at Naioth in Ramah. Then Saul sent messengers to take David. And when they saw the company of the prophets prophesying, and Samuel standing as head over them, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they also prophesied. When it was told Saul, he sent other messengers, and they also prophesied. And Saul sent messengers again the third time, and they also prophesied. Then he himself went to Ramah and came to the great well that is in Succoth. And he asked, where are Samuel and David? And one said, behold, they are at Naioth in Ramah. And he went from there to Naioth in Ramah, and the Spirit of God came upon him also. And as he went, he prophesied until he came to Naioth in Ramah. And he too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night. Hence it is said, is Saul also among the prophets? Now, don't you ever say that country music never makes a difference? It certainly did in Israel. I don't know how long it took for it to get to the charts and the DJs to be playing it all over central Israel on country KISH radio, but nevertheless, there was this song that originated when Israel and the troops came back from the war season with the Philistines. That was the season in which David had knocked off Goliath, and the troops came back, and the women of Israel came out dancing and singing, and part of their song was one that had to do with Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Now King Saul heard that, and they weren't trying to cut down Saul. They in fact meant to praise him, but they also meant to praise and celebrate David's victory. But Saul wasn't interested in the beat and the boom, not in the volume and the rhythm. He was rightly, as you should be, interested in the lyrics. And he heard them say, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul said, aha! They have ascribed 10,000s to David, but to me, they've only ascribed thousands. What more can he have but the kingdom? And so Saul eyed David to try to destroy him from that day on. And so began David's life on the ragged edge. In fact, most of the rest of the book of 1 Samuel is taken up with Saul being the hunter and David the deer. And he is seeking to destroy David. You might say, well, what does all that record and what do these two chapters in particular have to do with the believer in Christ? Well, you don't live very long as a believer in Jesus before you realize that though you may not face the same kinds of dangers that David faced with Saul, you realize how very fragile your life is and really how quite exposed you are. And you too need to know the protector that David had. And so that seems to be the keynote for God's people. You can sum up the main truth of these two chapters for the Lord's people in the words of Psalm 34, verse 7, which in a more literal translation would read this way, the angel of Yahweh keeps pitching his camp around those who fear him and pulls them out, that is, rescues them. That's the main thrust. So Saul may be the hunter, but Yahweh is a sun and a shield on his servant. And so we see this theme of God's protection. What's it telling us then? Well, first of all, I think it underscores the quietness of God's protection. The quietness of God's protection. That's mainly in chapter 18. If you read through all of chapter 18, you notice that the keynote that it seems to hammer away until you can't miss it is Yahweh's favor to David. The Lord shows and heaps favor upon David. Well, look at the chapter. I won't give you the verse numbers. You can figure it out yourself if you read them, but four times it refers to David being successful. Three times. It says specifically that Yahweh was with David. Six times, some form of the verb to love is used with David as the object. It might be that Michael loved David. It might be that Michael, Saul's daughter, or that Jonathan loved David, or that all Israel and Judah loved David. But David is held in high esteem by everybody. The Lord shows his favor to his servant David. over and over again, that's underscored. Alongside of that is another note that you see operating underneath, you might say, the print of the chapter. And that is that this one who knows God's favor is in extreme danger from Saul. And he doesn't really know it. You say, well, now wait a minute. Surely David knew something was really a ruck when in chapter 18, verses 10 and 11, when Saul was having one of his bad days, and David, as was customary, would play on his lyre and give the mood music that would tend to soothe Saul and so on. And Saul had his spear. Saul always has his spear. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he threw it at David and only caught Walbord and not David. David evaded him twice. Surely he knew that he was in danger from Saul. Well, not necessarily. Not that it was deliberate. You see, everybody around the palace knew that Saul had these spells. And they might have said to David, the king isn't well today. You come in and play, David. You know, it would be ascribed not to some deliberate malicious intent on Saul's part, but to Saul's sickness, his condition. Saul's not a well man. He has his ups and downs, and he's down today, so he'll do weird things. So David wouldn't necessarily, even though that was a threatening thing, to be sure, and life-threatening, I wouldn't necessarily think that Saul designed his destruction, you see. Saul wasn't, he just wasn't in his right mind quite there. So, it seems that David is really not aware of the maliciousness of Saul's design. But it's there. It's there. He decides that he'll offer his daughter. He offers Merab first, and he doesn't come through with that. And then he offers Michal, his younger daughter, to David as a wife. And Saul's design, as the narrator tells you in verses 17 and 25, is if I just get David fighting Philistines enough in order to make the bride price, you know, for my daughters, law of averages will catch up to him. You can't go fighting Philistines every day and keep coming back alive. Sooner or later, one of them's going to nail you, and that will be the end, you know, of David. And he won't even need to know. I won't have to come out with, I'll just let the Philistines do it. You might, by the way, be upset, I know, with the way things operated here, especially with the offer of Michal, Saul's daughter, how the king, through his servants, communicated to David that the only... You see, David didn't have a lot of wealth. He couldn't afford the bride price to pay to the father in order to become the king's son-in-law. And Saul said, well, all I want for a bride price is 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And so on. And David goes down and kills 200, and so on. And you say, my, you know, that is just, in your refined Presbyterian language, that just grosses me out. Well, don't worry too much about that. You see, if you think that war is ever refined, you don't know war. And it's not just biblical wars, and there was always fighting here in this time between Israel and the Philistines. And in fact, in ancient times like that, sometimes you got a count on how many you killed of the enemy. Sometimes they would cut their hands off, and then you would know by the number of hands you got from the dead in battle, a sort of a hand count, how many that you had actually knocked off, and so on. It just so happened that the Philistines, Philistine males, rather uniquely, didn't practice circumcision in that time. And so Saul told David, I want to be avenged on my enemies, the Philistines, and instead of the hands or something else, I want you to bring 100 foreskins. Well, David brought 200, and they counted them all out, and David got his bride, Michal. So that was not so unusual at the time, but the key thing that you need to see here is that beneath the surface, there is this secret danger to David's life. Yes, highly favored and given tokens of his favor by the Lord. And yet at the same time, there is this secret malicious danger that Saul is stalking David's life. And David is really unaware of it. He doesn't see it. And because of that, when the danger is kind of secret and hidden and undercover, you often don't see the protection of God very visibly either. Sometimes it's routine and ordinary and quiet. And you don't see it, at least not right away. It's kind of like the 1947 or 48, the Jews could not get arms into Palestine. They knew that if the Jewish state went into being, the Arabs would attack them. But they couldn't get arms in because the British had an embargo on them, and they would confiscate them if the Jews brought ammunition or guns or anything in at the ports. Well, there happened to be one arms buyer that made a purchase in Czechoslovakia, and he brought the got a tramp steamer out of a Yugoslavian port and had the shipment of Czech rifles and ammunition and so on. And then he had 600 tons of Italian onions dumped on top of them so that when they came into port in Israel, the British customs inspectors wouldn't be too likely to probe too deeply beneath the odor of those tons of onions in order to find what was really there. But the arms were there. They were camouflaged. That's kind of the way God's protection is here in chapter 18. It's there, but it's in camouflage. It's harder to see it. The danger is not even necessarily seen, at least by David. He doesn't realize it yet at the time. But God's protection is still functioning, but it's in the ordinary, the routine, not necessarily too visible. It's quiet. I mean, sure, David's job was to go against the Philistines to fight them in battle. You go against the Philistines again and again and again, and you come back again and again and again. It's all in a day's work, and you may not notice it at the time, but isn't God good to shield you the way he has? You have this quietness. You see, I think oftentimes you need to realize that the protection God gives to you, if you are his child, is often this quiet kind of protection. It's just in the run-of-the-mill routine and ordinary details of life and dangers you may not be aware that stalk you. You may not even know you're in peril of any kind, so that God protects you from it. And you may not even know that he protected you. Much of the protection of God you're not even aware of. And you better take that into account when you think. Now, secondly, not only the quietness of God's protection, but also the diversity in God's protection, the diversity in it. You go to chapter 19. If you look at chapter 19, you see that there are four episodes of deliverance or escape for David. Verses 1 to 7, 8 to 10, 11 to 17, 18 to 24. Four episodes of escape, and three of them are given a good bit of print. For example, just briefly, let's notice what they are. And Saul comes, you know, out in the open. He has a little cabinet meeting there with Jonathan, his son, the crown prince, and the rest of his servants, and he wants them to kill David. Well, Jonathan arranges an interview with Saul in which he talks the matter over with his father. He intervenes. He seeks to tell Saul, look, David has not done you any wrong. You were glad when he killed Goliath. The Lord worked a great deliverance, etc., etc. Now, what are you doing trying to kill innocent, shed innocent blood? Don't do this. And so Saul, kind of like a yo-yo, flip-flop and so on, went on oath saying, okay, I won't kill him. David's life will be preserved. So everything seemed to have been worked out by talking it out with Saul, and at least for the meantime, David was brought back into Saul's presence as before. That was through Jonathan. But then there's something with a little bit more suspense and tension. That didn't last long until Saul put holes in the wall again, trying to nail David while he was playing for him in one of his moods. And David knew that he had to escape. The jig was up. He had to get out. He went home. And in verses 11 to 17, you can imagine what it must have been like as Michal, David's wife, Saul's daughter, and she loved David Here you can imagine what the conversation must have been like. Intense, whispered perhaps in their small kitchen. David, you've got to get out of here. I want you, and I want you here, but I want you alive, not dead. And if you wait until the morning, they're going to nail you. Have you seen them? They're all around. They're watching the front door. And so, with Michael's assistance, David leaves through the window We don't know if it's like Joshua 2 and the house was built into the wall or not, but at any rate, David left by a way that they weren't expecting. He escaped. Next day, Saul's messengers come in and they say they want to see David and Michael. In our culture, it'd be like holding up a thermometer and say, my, he's got 103 temperature. I think it's the flu. He's sick. He really can't. So the messengers go back to Saul and they tell him, and Saul says, bring him up to me in his bed. I want to wipe him out. Well, they go back to Michael and David's house. They go in and they see, and lo and behold, it's a dummy in the bed. It says it was an image, teraphim, household images. You might say, good grief, I thought Michael was a good Presbyterian that worshiped the Lord and so on. What's she doing with those teraphim, those images? You know, I don't know. And I really wouldn't bother my head too much about it today, because I've heard people, who say that they believe in Jesus and in his sovereignty, and yet they go around talking to you and saying things and then say, knock on wood. I think there are some that just have some pagan superstition in them, and so don't throw the first stone at Michael if you've still got some of that. But at any rate, Michael did help, and Saul, of course, is all upset and wonders why Michael deceived him. And Michael tells a story for David. She said, David said to me, let me go. Why should I kill you, Michael? And so on. And so Michael covered herself up there. David escapes. Now, verses 18 to 24, you have a third episode. In this case, David went to Samuel near Ramah, not too far from Gibeah, where he would have been situated at Saul's place. And they go to Ramah, and Saul finds out about it. Our expectation, you see, is God used Jonathan to deliver David, then he used Michael to deliver David, now he must be going to use Samuel. Uh-uh. Samuel really can't do anything. He's just there. And he's supervising this group of prophets who apparently engage in some kind of singing, perhaps, or group worship, and so on. And so Saul finds out David's there with Samuel. He sends a posse after David to grab him and wipe him out. And lo and behold, it says that when that posse, that group of messengers came, the Spirit of God came upon the messengers of Saul, and they too prophesied. They joined in the worship service. So Saul sent another group. The same thing happened. He sent a third group. The same thing happened. And Saul got the point. You want something done right, you do it yourself. And so he took off after to Ramah. And it says that in verse 23, that when he went, the Spirit of God came upon him also. And he prophesied, and he too stripped off his clothes, and he too prophesied before Samuel and lay naked all that day and all that night and so on. Doesn't necessarily, incidentally, mean that he was stark naked, in case you're curious, but just that he had at least his outer robe off and so on. But the point is, in the story, you see, David's back is to the wall. He has no recourse. Samuel really can't intervene here. Saul is coming himself to shed David's blood. Now, when his servant has his back to the wall and there's no other help, he doesn't work in this case through anyone else. But it's the Spirit of God, the narrative says, that comes upon Saul's messengers and upon Saul and forces them, compels them to participate in the worship service. You say, I've never felt that kind of compulsion. You're fortunate, I suppose. But it was just, I call it God's vice grips. He just put Saul and his messengers under the crunch, and they have no choice. They're compelled by the sheer, raw power of God's Spirit. And they are rendered harmless, and they cannot touch David. It is a way of saying, no matter what means or instruments God uses, deliverance is always ultimately from the Lord himself. Now, there you have those various episodes. The thing I want you to notice about them is notice how what differences there are, what diversity there is in the way God delivers. Sometimes it might be by his sheer outright power imposing itself. Other times it might be through a very dramatic, tension-filled slip through the window with the help of your wife. Other times it might be just talking it out and trying to reason like Jonathan did with Saul. The many diverse ways. I hope you can appreciate that diversity. One of the things that's kind of frustrating, I suppose, for some who prefer diversity is the way some people always like sameness and can't break out of that. I remember when, no matter where we went, maybe to get ice cream, if my father went into a place, whether it had 12 different flavors or whether it had 31, when you ask him what he wanted, it was always vanilla. Just once you would like to hear him say, how about a scoop of cherry cheesecake or something like that, but that never came. It was always the same. Well, you see, the living God is not that way. He don't paint him into one method that he uses in protecting and delivering his people. He uses all sorts of a variety of ways and means, maybe through other people, etc. Such a variety. How refreshing God is in his ways. I hope you can delight in that. I hope you see how diverse he is. And in that diversity of his protection, you often see an unexpected twist, something that is even a little amusing, ironic, we sometimes call it. You have that here in chapter 19 as well. It's something like the situation that also occurred in the Jewish War in 1948. There was a kibbutz, I think it was south of Jerusalem somewhere, and the Arabs, including the Arab Irregulars and Arab Legion, were attacking it, and they finally overcame it. A couple of the Jewish defenders of the kibbutz escaped to a glade of trees near the kibbutz and hoped that as they threw themselves on the ground, they wouldn't be discovered. But they heard the snap of a twig, and they looked up, and they saw an Arab, an old, wrinkled, toothless Arab. He said, "Don't be afraid." Well, the Arab Irregulars came up and they slammed these two Jewish fellows against the wall there, and the old Arab put his body in front of theirs, and he said, "There's been enough killing today." They said to him, "Be quiet or we'll kill you too." And he stretched out his arms across these two Jewish men, and he said, "They are under my protection." Now, what a twist. How often do you have an Arab as a savior of a couple of Jews? It's that kind of twist that you see in the diversity of God's protection here in chapter 19. Look at it, and you have Saul, who is looking upon David to kill him and to wipe him out. And who is it that frustrates Saul's designs? Who is it that God uses to protect David from Saul's purposes? Saul's son, Jonathan. Saul's daughter, Michael. Do you get the joke? I mean, it's not a knee slapper. It's not that sort of thing. It's just mildly hilarious. It's just a tad amusing. It's that unexpected twist in the variety of God's ways. And what's that supposed to lead you to do? What am I to do with that, now that you say that's what the passage is indicating? Again, how about worship? You see, that's where it led Paul in Romans 11, verse 33, after he had talked about how God was working his purposes through Israel and the Gentiles and so on. At the end of Romans 11, 33, he's as if he threw up his hands and he says, "Oh, how unsearchable God's decisions are. How untrackable his ways." You can't trace God's ways. It's as if Paul is saying, doesn't God have a fantastic imagination? Just look at the ways he works. Isn't that something of what the writer's trying to bring you to do? Not to worry whether it will solve your personal problems or not, but to say, "My, doesn't God work in delightful ways? Isn't he a delightful God? Isn't he interesting? And shouldn't you tell him that he is?" Now then, thirdly and more briefly, there's also the instruction from God's protection. The instruction from God's protection. You look back over chapter 19. You remember we said there are four episodes of escape or deliverance there for David. And when you get at the end of chapter 19 and David is still alive and he's able to escape from there while Saul is rendered helpless by the Spirit of God, David isn't out of the woods yet. In fact, his life has just begun to come discombobulated and will be through almost the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. But he does have some instruction should he think about it. What's that? Well, if God has just enabled him to survive these four threats and episodes in chapter 19, and he has preserved him safely thus far, then doesn't it seem to indicate that he is not deserted, and that God will probably continue to act in that way toward David? You see, it's as if David takes stock of things, or could, if he'd had the mind to. We don't know what David did here. But you look back at all that and you say, my, if God has done this, he has shown me that he has not cast me off. These four escapes instruct David and ought to give him good hope of God's continuing care. Which simply means this in principle to you as a believer in Jesus. Oftentimes the clearest evidence that you are not deserted by your God is not that you have successfully come through your trial and it is in the past. The clearest evidence that your God has not cast you off is that you're still on your feet in the middle of your trials, as was David at the end of this chapter. So how much of David's experience can we write over into our lives? Can we sing, as it were, what he did for David, he'll do for me? I don't know. I don't know if I can say that, because you see, David was given a special promise by God, and he's on a different level from Ralph and the rest of us in this situation, because he was given a special promise by God that he would be the king of Israel and Judah. And he knew that specifically about his future. And if God was going to keep him, if he was going to bring that promise to pass, he had to keep David alive, obviously, for that. I don't have a specific promise about my future concretely like David did. He's on a different level of status, you might say, in God's kingdom purposes than I am. But I think the rest of the narrative would tell us, and that the rest of Scripture would tell us, that God will preserve me until whenever my work is done. You might say, I'd like a little bit more immunity than that. I don't know. I think that's enough. Of course, I don't know when my work's done. That's his definition. But I think it does assure me that the angel of the Lord keeps pitching his camp around me, and always will, till my work is done. You see, I don't have to go through David's experiences exactly. The important thing is that I know David's God. That's what's important for you. The God of whom Paul said in 2 Thessalonians 3:3, but the Lord is faithful. He will strengthen you and guard you from evil. So, I hope that I don't have to shinny out of a window and go running from my killers in the middle of the night and write Psalm 59 as a result of it. But I can still enjoy God's quiet, diverse, and instructive protection. Let us join together in calling the Lord our salvation and our protector.